Welcome to The Great Awakening. I'm your host, Josh Dawes. Today, I am excited to welcome Dr. Carl Truman to the show. Dr. Truman is the author of a couple of books that have been very influential in my thinking over the last 2 years. The first, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. And then his most recent, Strange New World, which tackles the same subject matter from a slightly different perspective and is in a more easily digestible form. Both books are a history of ideas that really try and explain how we got to a point in society where a man could say that he is a woman trapped in a man's body, and society goes along with that and even affirms that. So they're hugely important books for understanding the times that we're living in, and exactly the kind of things that we talk about here on the podcast. I think this is a great conversation. I'm incredibly grateful for Dr. Truman agreeing to come on. So let's jump right into the conversation with Dr. Truman. Dr. Truman, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. So your book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, came out almost 2 years ago. I read it when it first came out, and I was expecting, you know, to really be impacted. I'd heard all the buzz about it, but I was unprepared for how much it would shape my thinking over the last couple of years, and not for the reasons I thought going into it. You set out trying to answer the question of why, how on earth did society get to a point where a man could say, I am a woman trapped in a man's body, and society would, okay, yeah, sure, let's go with that. But the thing that really, so going in, I expected there's going to be history of ideas and philosophy that led us to this point. But what kind of took me by surprise was just how much that core idea of expressive individualism had shaped my own thinking. So it was very much a, I feel like I've spent the last 2 years just reexamining everything I've kind of taken for granted.
Right.
And like, where did that come from? So is that core idea of expressive individualism?
Well, expressive individualism is a term coined by Robert Beller in the 1990s in a book he co-wrote with a number of others called Habits of the Heart. And really, it's his attempt to summarize the way we imagine the world and our position in it at this particular moment in time. And if we were to boil it down, we'd say expressive individualism is the idea that the thing that's most important about us, really the feelings we have inside, we are constituted and defined by our feelings, and we feel authentic. We find our identity in being able to act out or perform those feelings in public. So transgenderism would be an extreme example. I feel I'm a woman. I need to be allowed to perform as a woman, even though I have the body of a man. That would be an extreme example. But as you've hinted at already in the introduction, it's not confined to transgenderism. It's not confined to LGBTQ identity politics. It's actually the way that many of us, if not all of us, think about the world in the West, that we tend to regard ourself as something that needs to be performed in public.
Yeah. When I read this, I recommended it to everyone. And, you know, some people took me up on that and were like, wow, that's a lot to think about. And so you've written a more condensed version. And so I was expecting that I'll just recommend that. And that came out. I read that and I'm like, well, you really need to read both because they're kind of coming at it from different angles.
Yeah.
So what is that second book?
The second book, on one level, it's an attempt to summarize the core arguments of the earlier book. Its origins lie in a suggestion slash request from my friend Ryan Anderson, who is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. When I published the big book, he got in touch with me and said, enjoyed it. There's a problem, though. Nobody's going to read it. It's going to be a hard sell to Washington staffers. We need something that gives the essence of the argument in a form that somebody could read, like a chapter while they're traveling to work on the on the metro or on the bus in the morning, the train. So I wanted to present the kernel, the essence of the argument in shorter compass, but also I had an opportunity to explore a few other themes that had emerged as a result of discussions arising from the bigger book. So I was interested in the role of what I call imagined communities, how we think, what are the communities that we think ourselves to belong to. Wanted to touch on the role of technology, things that I'd not been able to deal with in the bigger book. I mean, the bigger book was already over 400 pages. I didn't want to write a bigger book than that, but I do think these themes need to be explored because they do connect to the overall question.
I don't want to, you know, have you just summarize the entire history of it. You know, you can't summarize 400 pages and then a subsequent book. But what thinkers, what philosophers would you say have contributed the most to this idea of expressive individualism?
Yeah, it's a good question. I start my narrative with Rousseau, the 18th century Genevan philosopher. Now, you know, Rousseau has, there are precedents for Rousseau. Nobody emerges from nowhere, but he's as good a figure as anyone to start with because he's had so much influence on political theory, educational theory, the writing of autobiographies, on literature, et cetera, et cetera. Rousseau's a very influential figure. And I think his notion that it's society that screws us up, that if we were left to our own devices, that inner core would be who we really are, and it would be empathetic and civilized, et cetera, et cetera. We see that all around us in our social intuitions today. He was very influential on the Romantics, who translated his thought really into artistic forms. So he was a poet and a writer himself, but the Romantic movement that takes its cue to a large extent from Rousseau's writings really places art at the service of finding out who we are inside. It's stirring up and shaping our inner feelings. Then as we move on into the 19th century, really a key figure would be Sigmund Freud. If we think of Rousseau as psychologizing the self, then Freud is the man who sexualizes psychology. He's the guy who says, yeah, we are our inner space. Our inner space is absolutely decisive for our identity. But hey, it's not the noble savage of Rousseau's imagination. It's actually a dark and destructive force of which we ourselves are only vaguely aware, and that we need to think of human beings as driven by violent and sexual impulses. And then on into the 20th century, where Freud's thinking is picked up by a group of theorists of what we call the New Left, trying to reconstitute revolutionary Marxism in the wake of events in the early 20th century. And they make the obvious connection that I think is inevitable after Freud, that, hey, if sexual desire is identity, then laws about sexual practices are actually laws about who you are and are not allowed to be. And that sets up the play for where we are today, particularly on the identity politics front, where if you step back, it might seem bizarre that what goes on in the bedroom has become one of the most pressing public policy issues of our day. But if you come to the conclusion that what goes on in the bedroom is the most accurate representation of who you really are, then clearly what was traditionally regarded as private space becomes very public and very political at that point. So, you know, Rousseau, the Romantics, Freud, Herbert Marcuse, Wilhelm Reich, these are the guys that I think are significant articulators of the developing notion of the modern self.
And you mentioned earlier that in that second book, you touch on the role that technology has in kind of spreading these ideas. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. I mean, what technology does is it shapes how we imagine the world to be. If you live in the Middle Ages, you imagine that your life is tied to the seasons. Your rhythm of work is tied to the rhythm of the seasons. You and I are having a conversation over many hundreds, if not thousands of miles here, by virtue of technology, a conversation that we couldn't even have imagined in the Middle Ages taking place like this. When you then think of technology and, say, sexual behavior, 200 years ago, sex could not really be thought of as a recreation. because it carried too many risks. It carried risks of pregnancy that would then have involved long-term commitment, and it carried risks of disease, which could have had very unpleasant, if not fatal, results. So sex was high risk, and it came with responsibilities. Once you have technology, once you have contraception, once you have abortion, etc., the pathway to thinking of sex as recreation is opened up. My wife and I were out one evening in a town a few weeks ago. We were on our way to Philadelphia, stopped to grab dinner and stay the night in a town. We walked through a pro-abortion parade that was taking place. And one of the signs said, consent to sex is not consent to pregnancy. Well, that's a very modern sign, because 200 years ago, consent to sex was at least consent to the possibility of pregnancy. So there's a good example of how our whole way of imagining sex and sexual behavior has been transformed by technological developments that have given us cheap, easy, and effective contraception and abortion.
Okay, so your books do a great job of explaining how we got here. And I'm not going to ask you to answer how do we fix it now. But I do think as Christians, it's good to be aware of these ideas. I'm curious if you've put any thought into like what Christians can do to kind of, I don't know, rethink our thinking, to root this kind of thinking out of our life.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult. I mean, you alluded at the start to the fact that when you read the book, suddenly you realize, wow, I'm not reading about them out there. I'm reading about me. Well, mm-hmm. When I was writing the book, I ended up, hey, I'm not actually writing about people out there. I'm writing about my own heart here. This is my world that I'm decoding and becoming to better understand. So first of all, there's no simple one-size-fits-all silver bullet solution. There just isn't. Having said that, I would offer a couple of thoughts. One is, when you're able to understand a problem, you can reflect upon it in different ways. So if you're unaware that this is the water you're swimming in, you're not aware of it as being water. So I hope that once people become aware of, well, this is expressive individualism, and this is the logic of expressive individualism, and this is how it tilts us, this is how it shapes our imagination. At that point, I won't say we're liberated from expressive individualism, but we are at least loosened from it a little. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can spot it in three or four areas of our life where we never knew it was before, that's an advance. Even if there are 100 other areas where it's still deeply embedded, at least we've spotted three or four areas where maybe we can consciously work at this. Third thing I would say is, one of the aspects of modernity that I don't really touch on in the book, but I've become increasingly convinced is a very important aspect of the modern technological mindset, and that is we like things to happen quickly. So for us, if we're going to solve a problem, we're thinking about a solution by next Wednesday, or a solution, you know, politically by the next election cycle, or the next time a Supreme Court justice gets appointed, or something like that. We're looking for quick solutions. I think we need to realize that too is part of the modern mentality, and that as Christians, we need to be much more embedded in the long game. Mm-hmm. I think of Paul talking about in 2 Corinthians, his light momentary affliction compared to the eternal weight of glory that is to come. Well, if you read 2 Corinthians, it's very clear that Paul is not belittling his suffering there. He actually lays it out in painful, agonizing detail. What he's saying is, in the context of eternity, all of these horrors that I've outlined to you are like light momentary afflictions. And I think that long term, you know, we can talk about an eternal perspective, but I also think we need to have a long term perspective. We need to realize that as we want to transform ourselves, as if we want to loosen the bonds of expressive individualism, we need to be in it for the long game. And that may mean being in it not for our own generation, but two or three generations down the line. Why do I write the way I do? Well, I'm in my mid-50s. I was actually joking to the class this morning as I was teaching some of this stuff. I said, you know, I'm in my mid-50s. 30 years from now, I'll be dead or gaga or something. And I won't care about this stuff anymore one way or the other. You've got another 50, 60 years of caring and worrying about this. And what I'm trying to do there in classroom is is cultivate within younger people some of the thoughts, ideas, and approaches that will allow them to build and build better in the future. So as Christians, I think we need to realize, hey, surprise, surprise, it's not all about us and our generation. It's about being good stewards and about making sure that there is something decent and solid upon which the next generation can build. Mm-hmm. Maybe they will find a solution, maybe not, but maybe they will have built sufficiently that the generation after them will be able to build well and better than that which they have inherited.
That kind of flies in the face of kind of our post-war liberalism, you know, mentality of, you know, we're autonomous individuals who want, you know, you go out and you get a career and you maximize your earning potential. And, you know, I think the church has been so infected with that type of thinking. It's really hard to reconfigure even church life to think generationally like that.
Yeah. And it's not just generational. I think you're putting your finger on another point that at the heart of expressive individualism is this notion of autonomy. It leads us to think of ourselves as autonomous. Mm-hmm. And that leads ultimately to thinking of all human relationships as contractual. And we need to overcome that. So, you know, if you're asking me for a I've given a sort of outlook. How can we change our outlook on things that might be helpful? If I'm thinking of practical ways of addressing the problem, I would say, try to reimagine your life in a way where the relationships you have are not purely contractual and voluntary, but they're binding. And they bring with them obligations such that you have an obligation to your children, a natural obligation that you can't get rid of. You have an obligation to your wife. It was not a natural one initially because you chose, you voluntarily married her and she married you. But it's not a contract. Marriage is not a contract. Marriage is a solemn covenant. You take vows before God. Now, that's not to say that in extreme circumstances, you can't walk away from a marriage, extreme abuse, adultery. I think these are biblical grounds for marriage. But your wife having Alzheimer's disease or your wife no longer being physically attractive to you, they're not reasons for walking away. You are bound in a solemn covenant to your wife there, and you need to start thinking about your marriage that way. And that, of course, goes to the complicity of the church. Mm-hmm. Because the church has been complicit, for example, in no-fault divorce. It's not winked at no-fault divorce generally. Now, 50 years on, we reap the fruit of that. We see, wow, not taking a stand on that has left us vulnerable to a whole host of new configurations of marriage and human relationships. So, yeah, we've been complicit. We need, first of all, to confess our sins and repent on that front. And then we need to start living the lives we should have been living all along, showing how natural relations carry with them obligations and dependencies.
Would you say that it also extends on maybe a lesser level to your church family as well?
Yes. I mean, church family is tough because although I want to say the church is not a voluntary organization, in practice it often is. You know, we choose. You know, I love living in a nation with religious freedom. That's great.
Yeah,
and the plus of that is I can choose to go to church or I can not choose to go to church. That is huge and a beautiful, beautiful thing. The downside is I choose, and it kind of makes me a customer, and the church is providing me with a service that I can buy into or buy out of and flip from one congregation to another if I so choose. So church should embody this, but often doesn't, you know, for good reasons, because we live in a land with religious freedom. And this is where I think the marginalization of the church may do us a favor, because as the church becomes increasingly marginal in Western culture, well, marginal communities tend to be fairly tight-knit. People in marginalized communities tend to watch each other's backs. And I've said this repeatedly over the last year. I think it would be a great tragedy if all we do about our marginalization is complain and lament about it. And don't get me wrong, it's perfectly legitimate to lament that the word of God is disdained and God's people are shunted to the margins. That's a legitimate thing to lament about. But it shouldn't be all we do. I think we have to think in terms of, man, this is not just a setback. It may also provide us with opportunities for doing things that are good that we've never done before. I mean, I take the lack of real community that a lot of young people have That's a tremendous opportunity for the church.
Mm-hmm.
You tired of your thin online relationships? Come to the church, meet real people.
Yeah.
Go and have lunch at a real person's house on a Sunday. Be brought into their family on a Sunday. I think there could be tremendous opportunities for the church to capitalize on what's going on at this point.
Oh, totally agree. Yeah, I think we just got to get to the point where our lives look different than the world's going on. If we're you know, part of a church and we're just as invested in an online community and not connecting in the real life, and there's nothing there that is appealing. And I think we've got to rediscover that, those thick relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
I wanted to ask you about the experience of being in Matt Walsh's documentary. I was thrilled see you show up on that.
That was a hoot. Yes,
I didn't expect to see you there, but it was cool to.
I never expected to be in anything like that. So, yes.
What has the response been since you appeared in that?
It's been. I had numerous students emailing me saying, "Doctor, I just sprayed my coffee across the room. I'm watching this documentary." And I screamed and I said, "Mom, Dad, you need to come here and see. This is one of my professors." So I kept it pretty quiet. I do this stuff, but I don't care. I don't do social media. I don't care to brag about what I do. So I think it landed like a bit of a bombshell in among my students. I was recognized at a wedding by one person. Thankfully, a friendly person came up to me and said, "You were the guy in the documentary, weren't you?" And I was kind of glad that he liked the documentary and he wasn't going to punch my lights out. But it's been, I think, well received. I think there was a good review on one of the Notre Dame websites, University of Notre Dame. They have a magazine, an online journal by Abigail Favale, who's a former gender theorist, now a devout Catholic. She'd make a great guest, by the way, for your program. She'd be great on gender theory. She's written a wonderful book, The Genesis of Gender, that I'm recommending to anyone who'll listen. She did a review where one of the comments she made was she commented that I was the only person who'd used the word compassion in the documentary. And she felt that the documentary was strong on whacking the people who are driving this as a political and ideological movement,
mm-hmm.
and the pastoral care of individual lives and families that are being destroyed by it. So, and I think that she landed a good punch there. I thought the documentary was good. I think it's been well received. But as I thought about it, I thought, we always need to make a distinction between the individuals who are being destroyed by this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the evil people who are destroying them.
Yeah.
The former deserve infinite compassion and care. The latter, let's mock them, let's ridicule them, let's deal with them as ruthlessly as Matt Walsh does. But let's not forget that real human lives are being torn apart by this. I've never chatted to somebody struggling as a trans person who was happy.
Mm-hmm.
Struggling that way, and so we need to take that into account, I think, when we deal with this issue.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've been discussing this with people, that's been difficult, and I'm trying to help people see, is that there, like you said, there's a real distinction between the people who are targeting the most vulnerable among us with this ideology, and I think we're so conditioned and trained in the kind of gospel-centered church world that we want to love the LGBT community, that we're neglecting that there are activists within that community that are actively targeting minors and leading them into an ideology that has irreversible damage.
I think so.
The church needs to feel that urgency.
Yeah, and that's why that distinction is very important. I think if you don't make that distinction, then you will tend either to treat the evil people too kindly and mm-hmm. treat them as acting with too much good faith, or you will treat the people who are suffering as part of the same thing. They're all in it to destroy Western civilization. And so I think that distinction is very, very important pastorally and intellectually to maintain. And, you know, if I had one fear at the moment, I think the polarized nature of our politics makes that distinction very hard to maintain in Christian circles. People tend to tilt strongly to the one way or the other, and we have to resist that. Mm-hmm. We have to resist that.
What should the church be? How should the church be engaging on this? You know, do we need to be making documentaries, or is there a different way that Christians should be going?
Yeah, I certainly think Christians should be engaging on this. Whether the church as the church should be engaging on it is another matter. That becomes a question of calling and resources and everything.
Sure. Then.
But I certainly think that Christians need to be speaking out. We need to be using the public square. We need to be using the rights we have in the public square to speak out on this. We need to do it in a way that Christ would not be ashamed of. I don't think that, you know, turning up at funerals and screaming and shouting and shaking a fist at people, as has been done on the gay issue, is a good way of addressing it. But we should be speaking up. We should be making sure that pulpits, you know, I'm always hesitant about saying ministers should get involved in politics. We do not want to politicize the pulpit. The problem is so much of our politics now actually encroaches on things that you typically have dealt with from the pulpit, and it wouldn't have been political once upon a time. Right. But I do think we need two things pastors need to bear in mind is, one, they should not assume that young people, if you're a pastor of 45 or older, do not assume that young people in your church see as obvious in the Bible what you see as obvious in the Bible. I think you have And secondly, I've been saying this to students in class, you know, these questions like what is a woman, these are interesting questions, but they're not the most important question. They actually tend to be functions of a much deeper and in some ways less contentious, less politically contentious, but more important question. And that's, what does it mean to be human? And I think churches need to be teaching, you know, whether it's under the rubric of creation or whatever, churches need to be teaching people today, what is the Christian vision of what it means to be a human? And that's something I think that if you get that right, then you have the tools to handle whatever lunacy the next transhumanist moment throws our way. If you've got a good grasp of positive truth, you can handle the counterfeits. So I would say in church, yes, be rightly wary about turning your pulpit into a political platform, but do make sure that you're teaching on what it means to be a human. Because if you do that and you do it well, then your congregation are well prepared to deal with the kind of things they're getting from TikTok or from the news or from social media.
That's great. Well, I do want to respect your time. I always ask my guests one final question.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of black pills in the world. It'd be easy to just come to despair, but what is giving you hope right now?
I think this may sound counterintuitive. What's given me hope right now is that I've come to terms with the fact that I'm going to lose every cultural struggle that I engage for the rest of my life. That's very liberating because that frees me up to work for future generations. I don't have to. Optimism always leads to despair. If I think I'm going to solve all the world's problems by next Wednesday, man, I'm going to be suicidal by Friday. So I think having a realistic understanding of what I can do in my lifetime and being faithful with that little, that's key. And then, of course, we know who wins. We know that the Lamb wins. We know that this whole mess comes to an end with the joyous marriage feast of the Lamb. Who knows how long it's going to take to get there? I don't know if what I do will play any significant role in what happens between now and that great moment. But praise God, it doesn't depend upon me. So hope, I think, comes for me, or lack of despair comes from knowing we're playing the long game here. I'm not working for next Wednesday. I'm working for future generations. And secondly, the ending's already decided. We've already passed D-Day. Now, many of us may get shot and killed on the long march from D-Day to Berlin, but Berlin is going to fall. It's going to fall. Whether I get there to see it or not, it is going to fall.
That's great. Couldn't agree more. That's excellent. As I understand it, you've got another book you're writing on critical theory?
Yeah, in fact, I got a couple of book projects on the go. I've got one on critical theory that's due to be submitted next year, and that'll be a sort of introduction for undergraduates or seminary students trying to set critical theory, particularly early Marxist critical theory, against the background of Marx. And I'm working on a plan on a book on nihilism in the modern age as well. That's a new project I've got that I'm turning over. So wanting to really continue to work on the kind of themes that I hinted at in the earlier books, but have not been able to work out in any great detail as yet.
Well, excellent. I look forward to reading both of those. Dr. Truman, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great day.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
That's our show for today. Big thanks to Dr. Carl Truman for joining me for this conversation. You can find links to where you can purchase these books in the show notes. I highly encourage you to pick those up, to read one, both of them. They are incredibly valuable for understanding the times we're living through right now. Please share this content with your friends. I think Dr. Truman is someone that the church really needs to be listening to, even, you know, beyond the church. He's just a really clear thinker about the times we're living through and helps kind of cut away the fog and helps really expose the way that our thinking has been shaped by a lot of these ideologies. Please give us ratings and reviews over at Apple Podcasts. That helps to get the show out there to more listeners. If you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit like and subscribe. And we will see you soon.